This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The United Nations is sounding another warning on climate change, declaring the window of opportunity to keep global warming below devastating levels is closing fast. The UN's emissions gap report says richer countries are not doing enough or even promising enough in order to cut emissions caused by burning fossil fuels. It says the world's on track to be almost 3 degrees warmer by the end of the century, which would mean catastrophic climate breakdown. People have already heated the planet by at least 1.1 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times, and the consequences are being felt.
Greenhouse gas emissions must be cut by 45% this decade. Under current policies, the world is headed for 2.8 degrees of global heating by the end of the century. In other words, we are headed for a global catastrophe.
The world is heading towards climate catastrophe. Who says so? Some fringe bloggers? No, it's the United Nations. On October 26th, the World Meteorological Organization, or the WMO, held a press conference in New York. They confirmed what Radio EcoShock guests have been saying for more than a decade. Despite all the climate conferences, the green talk, the breathless announcements of new technology, all three of the worst greenhouse gases increased even more this year. We are heading towards catastrophic warming of about 3 degrees C within this century. All the heat waves, the fires, and the massive floods this past summer confirmed it. It showed us. But for over a decade, climate scientist Paul Beckwith has warned us about this with his hundreds of YouTube videos explaining the science behind it. Now Paul's research field has moved from the fringe to center stage. He told you so, including in his many appearances on Radio EcoShock. We are going to thrash through breaking climate science and Paul's plan to take to the upcoming climate conference in Egypt this month. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to chat with you on your program.
Okay, so before we dig into the new papers putting facts to our worst fears about climate, how does it feel to come back from your summer break to find authorities finally willing to admit fossil fuels are addictive and we are failing to slow climate change at all?
Well, on the one hand, it's nice to have lots of company, instead of being sort of the bearer of just alarming news on the climate front. You know, there's lots of voices now that are to have company, but then on the other hand, it's not nice to be correct about how bad it was going to become. And it's always a surprise, even to me, how quickly the climate catastrophe is deteriorating.
It is. You know, I've been following this for years and thinking, well, maybe I'm just an alarmist. But then things come up like 50 degrees summer in Canada and then the fabulous fires, a third of Pakistan goes underwater. And I think, well, even I wasn't really up onto it enough. That report, by the way, for listeners, was released on October 26th from the UN Environment Program. It's called Emissions Gap Report 2022, The Closing Window, and I'll put a link to that on my blog, of course. And they say greenhouse gases are just increasing. NBC News gave it less than 2 minutes of their coverage and then spent 10 minutes on the last mass murder, the elections in Georgia, and general fluff. So let's get down to it, Paul. How do you picture a world almost 3 degrees C hotter on average?
It's really tough to kind of imagine because we're only 1.1, 1.2 degrees Celsius. You know, that's above the turn of the century baseline because we always have to keep in mind the baseline that's used. So, you know, most people now use the average temperature between, say, 1880 and 1910. And that's become the assumed pre-industrial, they call it pre-industrial assumed baseline, you know, without ever mentioning that's what it is. And of course, you know, in the original climate reports and IPCC reports, the original temperature of the 1.5 safe temperature or 2 degrees temperature was first and then 1.5. You know, those were originally based on the 1750 temperatures, so you need to add 0.2 or 0.3 degrees Celsius to those. And also, there's certain months of the year when we have actually exceeded that 1.5 Celsius, if you use the original baselines, or if you use the 1880 to 1910, we've had entire months over about 1.3 already, and at least I'm starting to hear of some UN reports and others saying that, yeah, 1.5 is, forget about 1.5, that's going to be next to impossible. I mean, you just have to do the math, how much we're rising each year, each decade, or, and, you know, where we're at now. But, I mean, in terms of the catastrophes and extreme weather, mostly caused by extreme weather events, I mean, those are just getting out of control in many places, you know, all around the world. I mean, it's pretty clear that we're in a world of consequences now to the temperatures we've already reached, let alone, I mean, 3 degrees is kind of, you know, I mean, we're talking about collapse, you know, well before then, collapse of the global food supply, and then huge geopolitical conflict and things going on. I mean, there seems to be no end to the bad news on abrupt climate system change science.
Well, right. I think the blockbuster new paper for me is titled Climate Endgame, Exploring Catastrophic Climate Change Scenarios. I spoke with the lead author, Luke Kemp, in last week's Radio EcoShock show, and I urge listeners to go back and grab that if you missed it. You did one of your longest videos yet on this paper. What talks to you about it?
Well, I mean, the main thing is, of course, is that now this is a peer-reviewed paper. Right, because it doesn't sound much different from what you and I have been discussing on your program for years. And, you know, what a handful of other people have been talking about for years. But to see it sort of as a peer-reviewed paper, as a new area of study, I mean, they're talking about we need a lot more research on this. We can't just, you know, that this is happening to us, you know, on our planet right now. So it's about time that the scientific reticence was put aside and the reality was examined from a scientific point of view in papers. So this is just sort of beginning, I think. I think a lot more, there'll be a lot more similar papers. I mean, how can there not be? Some of the videos and work I've been doing recently is on the ocean warming. You know, how the intermediate depth ocean warming is undercutting all of the glaciers, not just in Greenland, but also in Antarctica, and not just in West Antarctica, but also in East Antarctica. Scientific studies and most people think that East Antarctica's ice is rock solid. It's not going anywhere. But it turns out that there's large fingers of the ocean that penetrate under the ice shelves, and they're greatly increasing melt rates even in the last, you know, decade or two of glaciers that, if they do go, will raise global sea levels several meters.
That seems coming for sure, and I want to talk about that in detail. But before we get there, I also want to ask you about your plans to present this Climate Endgame paper and more at the COP27 Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt this month.
Yes, the conference, it runs from November 6th. It runs for 2 weeks, and I'll get there just like the day before it starts. And I'm doing lots of press conferences with a group called the Climate Emergency Forum, and also probably several with another group called Facing Future. We have sessions. The UN keeps changing the number of sessions that we have. So originally we applied for and were accepted to give a press conference every single day, but that was cut in half about a week ago. So now we have a session every other day in the actual press conference room, but we'll probably be doing presentations and putting together videos on, you know, every day as we originally anticipated. So, you know, things that I'll be emphasizing, of course, are, you know, the climate endgame paper, of course, and the recent peer-reviewed papers talking about how bad the situation is. There'll be a lot of emphasis on the Arctic and on the warming oceans and also on the droughts that we've been seeing around the world, leading to rivers completely drying up. I mean, this is happening in many, many places. And the extreme weather events increasing in frequency, severity, and duration, and happening in regions where they didn't happen before. The increase in tropical storms turning into large category hurricanes, and talk about, you can throw away the sort of the idea of a 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 year event, because that the climate system has changed, so those numbers are pretty meaningless. And you know, we have to make hard choices as a society, like why rebuild the whole Fort Myers region in Florida, for example, just to have it destroyed with another storm in a few years. And of course, you know, Canada experienced Fiona, and I know I have several friends who live in Prince Edward Island who lost their cottages on the North Shore. They were actually moved by the wind off their foundations, and they've been written off by insurance companies. Climate change is accelerating, and the consequences are more and more severe, and it's happening to more and more people around the world. So I'll try to talk about the science, but also bring in, you know, the human element. And, you know, we all have to keep in the back of our mind how we grow our food and how we distribute our food, because we're really heading rapidly to global food crisis with lots of starvation.
You have at least 500 climate teaching videos on your site, paulbeckwith.net, and your YouTube channel, of course. And let's talk about a couple of recent videos. Over a decade ago, you started out warning about a possible methane spike in the Arctic with the super warming gas coming up from the seabed. Well, since then, of course, we've seen a lot more science about that. So that hasn't happened yet, but suddenly everyone wants to talk about methane again. Tell us about the surprising discovery of warming waters below the surface of the North Atlantic Ocean that you covered recently.
Yes, there's huge consequences that result from a greatly warming ocean. And we know that climate change is really, it's a huge ocean warming problem. I mean, you know, over 90% of the excess heat that's being captured by the Earth's system is going into the oceans, warming the oceans. And the intermediate waters, intermediate depth waters, that warming is enormous, because it not only does it melt the ice shells, and it goes far inland into Greenland in these channels, also in Antarctica, and it melts the ice from below. And in Greenland, there's a lot of interactions between the meltwater on the surface, which then drains down through the ice to the bedrock, where the ice is resting on the bedrock, and it causes these plumes of meltwater, because it's fresh, so it's buoyant, it's light, and that water comes out at the edge of the ice shelf where the ice is grounded on the bedrock, and then it rises up because the seawater around is very salty. Although it's colder, the seawater, it's heavier. So this meltwater comes up and causes these plumes, which then cause turbulent flow next to the ice and greatly increases the melt rates. So this is happening in Greenland. In Antarctica, you know, it's still colder above the surface, so you don't get a lot of surface melt unless you're in the, say, Antarctica Peninsula that extends to the highest latitudes for the whole continent of Antarctica. You know, even on East Antarctica, we're getting warm seawater penetrating underneath the ice, causing melt. And they've done some interesting studies using instrumentation on seals and on, you know, on some marine creatures that you can't direct where they go, of course, but they naturally swim all over in the water. And you, if you're measuring temperature and salinity of the water and you have the location of them, then you can get lots of data. But they're using these floats, which sit at the bottom, and they rise up to the surface under the ice every 5 days or so, and then descend back to the ocean floor, measuring temperature and salinity. So all of these sort of things show a great warming of this water, the intermediate water, which melts the ice on the coast of Antarctica as well as Greenland. And then also the warming water is actually warm enough to thaw out the marine sediments, and embedded within the marine sediments, there's methane class rates, if you like. It's like the methane molecule, CH4, the gas molecule, surrounded by frozen water, in sort of like a lattice, and that keeps the methane trapped in the sediments, but that water lattice is thawing away, it's melting away, releasing the methane, and there's a lot of evidence from the paleo records that there's been huge outbursts of these methane class rates with water temperatures similar to what we're seeing today. So it was referred to originally by the original papers, Kennett's papers, as the methane gun, if you like, the methane class rate gun. So there is a risk, and we know that the methane levels are greatly increasing in the atmosphere through a number of different reasons. You know, as you mentioned at the beginning, all of the greenhouse gases are on hitting levels that they haven't been at before in, modern times, and they're just causing tremendous warming around the planet.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest climate scientist, Canadian climate scientist, Paul Beckwith. You have a presence on Facebook as well. You recently posted study, Arctic sea ice loss leads to more frequent strong El Nino events. Now, this is an interesting debate here because in September, I interviewed the longtime scientist Dennis Hartman, and he found that climate-driven changes in Antarctica could bring more years like the last three, dominated by La Nina. And that makes sense because we call it ENSO, the La Nina El Nino system is called ENSO, and that includes the Southern Oscillation. It's part of the Southern Hemisphere. But I suppose there isn't a conflict here because La Nina years may become more common, but when El Nino develops, watch out. What do you think, Paul?
Yes, my next few videos, I've been focusing on the intermediate water warming, the relationship to the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the undercutting of the glacier in Greenland in the paleo records, which caused the ice-rafted debris surges known as Heinrich events, and also the effect of the methane class rates, and that was on the continental shelf off Africa near the equator. And my next few videos, I'll be talking about East Antarctica. I talked about the huge glacier melt for the Thwaites Glacier in Western Antarctica, and that was a fascinating study where they used the underwater autonomous vehicle plus data from sensors on seals. But the Denman Glacier in East Antarctica is an enormous glacier. It's near the Totten Glacier. Yeah, I haven't done that video yet. This is where they've also measured warm water infiltrating under the glacier by various means and show that this is an unstable glacier because it's a retrograde slope. So the water depth increases significantly as you go inland. In fact, it reaches up to 3,500 meters deep, you know, very, very deep. So if the warm water gets in there, then the grounding line retreats, and it's retreated, I think, 5 kilometers or something in the last decade or two already. So it's rapidly retreating the grounding line, and that's where the glacier sits on the bedrock. That's the outermost part closest to the ocean where the glacier actually sits on the bedrock. So as that retreats, depending on the topography of the seafloor, the glacier can really accelerate, and you can get enormous melt if you have these retrograde slopes, which is the case for this Denman Glacier. But also, the loss of the sea ice, you know, has huge effects on glacier melt, on ice shelf melt, because the ice acts as kind of like a cork in the bottle, if you like. But also, huge loss of sea ice is changing the distribution of heat, the amount of heat that is moving up from the equator to the far north in the Arctic, and so when that heat flows down and less of it goes far north, then there's more accumulating closer to the equator. And there's a new paper that just came out that you're referring to just a few days ago I saw it. And it talks about as we lose more and more sea ice, there's these teleconnections, and we can expect more powerful El Niños to occur as we go to a world with less and less sea ice. So, you know, this is a very hot area, if you like, pardon the pun, of research, because you know, we've had 3 years right now of La Niñas, and everybody, you know, that will end at some point. And when we next have the El Nino, or the period, the time where a lot of heat comes out of the ocean, then we'll probably just totally destroy all temperature records. You know, it'll be the hottest year ever by a very, very large margin. If you look at the past El Ninos, they seem to be getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah, we've been shocked by recent weather, and that's during the weaker system, the La Nina, so we ain't seen nothing yet. Paul Beckwith, you've specialized in tracking Arctic sea ice and conditions in the Arctic. What is the status of the sea ice, and have we gone so far into warming that that doesn't matter as much anymore?
Well, the Arctic sea ice, it seems to be hanging on longer than I would have expected. And I think the reason is that there are some negative feedback, some breaking feedback that are actually slowing down the melt. And what the primary one is, that is, you know, after a very intense melt year, close to record melt year, loss of Arctic sea ice, then in the fall, when the Arctic turns colder, the ice growth is enormous. And if you look at the physics of ice growth, as the ice, so the growth is always fastest when it's initially forming, and then actually as the ice thickens up, the growth gets slower and slower because the ice is a very good insulator. So if the, you know, the ice is forming because of the cold atmosphere above, the ice gets thicker, there's less heat exchange through the ice, so there's less heat that will be lost from the water through the ice, and of course the ice is forming onto the, from below, it's building up on the bottom of the ice. So that's one effect, and, you know, there seems to be some other effects in play. The best peer-reviewed science is still talking about no ice, ice-free, you know, with a decade or two. I mean, that number, there's a lot of papers coming out that are studying that. And I mean, the bottom line is we just don't know for sure, but it's coming. I mean, the trends are all to no sea ice. And I think after we have no sea ice in the summers in the Arctic, it won't be that long before, you know, we have less and less ice year-round. Eventually go to no ice year-round.
Cool. More vacation properties for everybody. Well, yeah, not so good. So the world leaders from the UN are finally ready to admit we're failing to control emissions, and disaster seems our most likely course. And the next step is surely an attempt at geoengineering to cool the planet. And our guest Luke Kemp last week also wrote a paper studying the injecting of aerosols into the atmosphere, and he concludes it's still too risky, partly due to the human factors. I mean, just look at the United States. You had some progress during the Obama years, or at least better talk about the climate, and then, of course, Trump just threw it all out the window, and now it's sort of back with Joe Biden, but not really. Humans can't hold a steady course, and yet that's exactly what's needed once you start cooling the planet with stuff in the atmosphere. What are your current thoughts on this, Paul?
Well, it looks like that the effect of aerosols on the climate, I mean, there's two effects. There's the direct effect, where the aerosols can actually block sunlight and cause some cooling on the surface, depending on their altitude. But there's also the indirect effect, where the aerosols act as cloud condensation nuclei and cause clouds to, you know, when there's water, enough water vapor in the atmosphere, then there can be condensation onto the droplets and cloud formation. Then the aerosol size is very important, because the smaller the cloud condensation nuclei, then the smaller the cloud droplets will be, and the more highly reflective they are, and the more cooling they would cause on the surface. So there are programs that have reduced aerosols in the last number of years, like from ships, for example. Also, COVID reduced emissions significantly from less industrial production. But of course, that's, you know, industries roared back after that. So there's all of these factors going on, but it does appear that the so-called global dimming effect is actually larger than scientists expected. The most recent few peer-reviewed papers on it show that the effect might be larger. It might be closer to, say, a degree Celsius rather than half a degree Celsius. What this means is, it means that the effects of aerosols being generated as part of geoengineering programs will actually have a larger impact on the climate than we probably expect at the moment. It'll be easier to cool the planet with aerosols in the atmosphere than we expected from the science. But then, of course, there's the argument. The argument is that you have to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. Well, the idea is that we have to slash fossil fuel emissions and usage and something like aerosols generation in the atmosphere to cool the planet to buy us time to slash the emissions is, I still think that's the way we're going to have to go. I mean, governance is going to be a big issue, as you say. And then there's also the idea that, you know, we would just need, if you or I could convince Elon Musk that we needed to do this, you know, it could be done very, very quickly, right? It wouldn't require a government to do.
Of course, that's one of the scary parts, too. We might have the Korean dictator decide to do it, or just some independent actor, a billionaire, will cool the planet. And I don't know. I think that's going to be an ongoing debate. I just saw a new climate podcast has come out, and it has Chevron for a sponsor. You know, the oil company that really cares about wrecking the future with its products. Has Chevron offered to sponsor your mission to teach the world climate science on YouTube or your trip to the Egypt climate conference, Paul?
No, and same with Coca-Cola. They haven't either. Although they are sponsoring part of the climate conference. They're giving money. Like, it's very funny world that we're in. Like, it seems to get more and more chaotic and ridiculous. Time goes on.
Perhaps we live in a clown universe. You know what I'm saying? It's actually a funny chaos.
Yes, it is. And I don't know if you've heard, but at least over CBC and, you know, other broadcasts lately, I keep hearing these ads on the radio for carbon capture is important, and you know, the big five or six operations in the Alberta tar sands, the oil sands, are all working hard to have carbon capture to make their work, you know, low emissions. So there's a lot of greenwashing going on all over.
Yeah, it's like sort of heroin addicts saying, well, we're going to keep doing heroin, but we're going to sweep up the streets and make sure there's no needles around. You know, it doesn't solve the problem at all. I am seeing more climate scientists going the route of public education, as you chose to do. We have Kevin Trenberth with his public-friendly climate book out now, and Box offers his video series called Faster Than Forecast. Michael Mann is doing public-facing books as well. But they can't do it all, the detailed science and the public speaking. We seem to need a new role, some kind of large-scale medium. I don't know, maybe a 24/7 climate TV channel or hey, here's a radical idea. Let's teach this to our kids in every grade in school. How do you think we could reach the world in time?
Yeah, you know, the public is used to daily or even hourly weather forecasts, right? You know, you get the news and you get a couple minutes of weather, right? I think we need to have a climate part. Like, so get the news, couple minutes of climate for all programming, you know, all mainstream programming, just to keep getting that message out to people. Yeah, I've often thought that's what's needed. Different stations, as you say, different climate scientists are having their own programs and books, more to get information to the public. Large news stations are having their own climate departments and so on. So we're seeing all these changes. It just seems to, it seems like the changes in the actual climate system are far faster than any of these changes on the human scale. But I've talked about the idea of reaching a tipping point in human understanding and in human behavior and human action on the climate problem. And, you know, maybe we're always getting closer to that point, but where is it? Some people talk about 5% take up being sufficient to start then tipping over to, you know, exponential increase. But it just seems to be taking a long time, that's all. With an exponential change, it does seem things seem to take a long time, and then suddenly, whoosh, you know, you're in a different situation.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest climate scientist, Paul Beckwith. Well, we can hope for that. I know that some of my listeners have given up hope. They're stocking up on beans in the basement, hoping to stay alive somehow while the heat and the social breakdown unfold. Others are going on travel holidays, a big flight, figuring this might be their last chance. How do you cope with what you know, Paul?
Well, I got a puppy not too long ago. I have a few cats, one less than I did because one of my sons went off to university and he brought one with him. Unfortunately, I couldn't get the other two to follow suit. So I still have the two cats and now one dog. And he's, you know, it's just I guess, one day at a time. I find actually a lot of the work I do is actually, you know, it's sort of double-edged because a lot of it shows you how bad and quickly things are progressing with climate change. But then on the other hand, it does make me feel sort of I'm actually trying to do something, do some good, you know. I try to keep up on all of the different climate science, not become specialized in one particular region. I also try to work a lot with people that are thinking of climate solutions. And this is why, you know, I do allow myself to travel once a year to the climate conference, the COP, because I do a lot of networking with people. I meet a lot of the scientists that are putting out the papers. I also get a chance to make more media contacts with people and also people that are working on solutions in different organizations and so on. So it's very valuable to me for that reason. But so yeah, I just kind of plod along. And you know, another thing I used to just read entirely nonfiction books, you know, mostly climate books and then other, you know, science books. But I've spread out. I'm reading lots of fiction. I try to have a fiction book on the go whenever I have a nonfiction on the go. Talking about people like I like Clive Cussler and Stephen King. And John Grisham is the most recent author who I've discovered. You know, these are people that have written quite a few books, so there's always good fiction books to read, and it's a bit of an escape, I think.
It's part of the creativity of humans, and we have seen a renaissance in science with this climate drive. Some most amazing things have been set up, as you talked about. I mean, putting sensors on seals and sending them under the or following them under the Antarctic ice. I mean, this is fantastic stuff. We are finding out how the world works. So if we survive this challenge, I think we're going to have a much better picture of how we could work with nature instead of against it. Will you report back to our listeners from Sharm El Sheikh if we can set up a decent connection?
Yes, that sounds like a great idea. Be very happy to do that.
From Ottawa, Canada, we've been speaking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You can find him at paulbeckwith.net. I recommend you go there. You can also track all the science and videos we talked about today in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Paul, thank you for helping us out again, and I hope to talk to you in a few weeks from Egypt.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Scorching heat in the U.S. South underlines the absolute dependence on air conditioning and the grid that powers all those machines. Now AC is moving much farther north to Portland and Seattle, never mind the oven that was Spain, Portugal, and even Paris in 2022. Stan Cox wrote about all this in his 2010 book, Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. We talked about it on Radio EcoShock. But there is another Stan Cox. Beyond his 6 books, by day Stan was for years lead breeder for the Land Institute sorghum program. His work partnered with 7 countries, from India through Africa to America. We will find out why this food staple matters even more in a warming world. But now Stan has joined the Ecosphere Studies team at the Land Institute. He is tracking the global ecologic emergency. From Salina, Kansas, Stan Cox, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, good to be back with you, Alex.
12 years after you and I rang the bell on air conditioning, machine cooling is spreading farther around a warming world. Does it still cause you to worry about it?
Yes, it certainly does, because around 2012, a couple of years after we talked, finally you started seeing a lot of concern in the U.S. about air conditioning and the fact that both through refrigerants and through energy consumption, that it is responsible for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and ensuring that future summers will be even hotter. But around that time, the prompt for this increased concern was not what I'd been bringing up, that we, you know, way overuse air conditioning in this country. It was that a lot of other countries that have a lot of high temperature areas are now taking up air conditioning, and they have a lot of people, you know, India, China, and that's going to ruin the atmosphere, cause runaway global warming and so forth. So the kind of thing that nobody wanted to think about when it was just us doing it, then there was a lot of alarm. But of course, nothing is being done about either.
I suppose heat pumps are a slight advance over the old air conditioning technology.
Well, they're an advance for heating. They are an advance over burning fuel oil or natural gas or using electricity from a power plant for heating elements and that kind of thing. But a heat pump is just a reverse air conditioner, and so there's the indirect savings of emissions from heating, but it will still be using the same amount of energy and causing emissions for running it as air conditioning.
All right, well, let's switch over here. Now, you spent over a decade working on a crop that is just not well known by listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. I wasn't really familiar with it. What is sorghum and why does it matter?
Sorghum is in volume produced and used, is the fifth most important food grain on Earth. It originated about 8,000 years ago in the area of East Africa that is today South Sudan, somewhere around there. And it's a plant that looks, right before it produces seed, it looks very similar to a corn plant. It's in the same part of the grass family, but it produces its grain at the top of the plant where corn has a tassel, so it doesn't have an ear, but it has a head full of grain at the top. It spread around from Africa into Asia through tropical areas throughout ancient times, and it was only in the mid-20th century that American farmers started growing grain sorghum. There was also forage sorghum, which the stalks and leaves are fed to cattle. But unlike the sorghum in Africa or South Asia, which is almost 100% eaten as human food, kind of like it makes a product kind of like cornmeal, in the United States, almost all of it goes either toward feeding livestock or in producing fuel ethanol to run cars and trucks. And it's primarily, I'm here in Kansas, in the center of the country, and the bulk of the grain sorghum in the U.S. is grown in a kind of a strip up the middle of the country from Texas through Oklahoma, Kansas, and a little bit into Nebraska.
So there are different types of sorghum, some grown like a cereal for humans, as you say, and some grown in fields as fodder for animals. I was surprised to learn that excess heat and drought, and we've seen lots of that, can turn sorghum fodder somewhat toxic. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, and that's generally in the younger part of the sorghum's life. So it sprouts in the spring and comes up and may look like a field of corn seedlings coming up. And that young, fast-growing vegetation, if there is a drought or, conversely, a freeze or some kind of stress, it can cause the plant to produce something called prussic acid, which is a compound that, you know, if the cattle eat it, that prussic acid will produce hydrogen cyanide, the notorious poison, and kill them. And so breeders in the United States have worked on developing sorghums that don't respond to stress that way and don't produce prussic acid. But in general, they generally avoid having cattle graze on sorghum just to be sure. They will then, you know, later cut it for silage, or after the crop is harvested, they can, cattle can go out and eat the dry stalks. But the sorghum that I've been working on here at Land Institute for a couple of decades is something that is not in commercial production yet. It's still in the experimental stage, a perennial sorghum, which instead of being planted every spring, being harvested in the fall, and the plants dying off, then you have to do tillage or herbicides or something and then disturb the soil again in the spring and sow again. Instead of that, perennial sorghum will survive through the winter as underground stems, so you don't see any life there at all. But then if those stems survive and put up shoots in the spring, so you get a second crop, third crop, etc., each season without having to replant.
And how's that going? Do we have that?
Well, as I said, we're still in the breeding stage, but we've made a lot of advances so that now we're getting close to having varieties, not varieties, but breeding lines that are perennial and do produce decent grain, but we're, at this point, they are going to be mainly targeted toward the tropics and subtropics, and most particularly toward parts of African continent, because the underground stems they produce are not quite winter hardy enough to survive a Kansas winter. That's one of the reasons we're targeting tropics. And the other reason is that we're aiming it to be specifically a food grain, because we wouldn't go to all this work just to have it used in factory farming of animals or fueling SUVs. So we're working with colleagues in Uganda and other countries who will be taking what the perennial sorghum we've developed, making crosses, hybridization with their locally adapted annual sorghum and selecting perennial sorghum there.
Well, taking a realistic view, some experts on climate change suggest humans will have to adapt what we eat. We may have to switch our diets to more heat-resistant crops, and sorghum is often mentioned. Could sorghum help feed a warming planet?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, already in places like the high plains here in western Kansas, down through the Texas Panhandle, sorghum, because of its heat and drought tolerance, has displaced a lot of corn that be grown there otherwise. And that's the reason in these semi-arid parts of the African continent also are traditionally sorghum growing. And they're places where maybe people prefer corn, but it's too unreliable because of heat and drought, and sorghum is much more reliable grain producer.
Well, yes, let's talk about Kansas for a minute. The state government says agriculture is the largest economic driver in the state. It's worth at least $76 billion annually, and that's bigger than the gross domestic product of about 130 countries by my count. So, Stan, I heard that the so-called dry line is advancing towards Kansas, and what is the predicted climate future for this critical food-producing state?
Yeah, you're right. The dry line is a line running north-south, west of which the amount of rainfall and precipitation that an area gets on average is less than the amount of moisture that is pulled out of the ground by plants or evaporates from the surface of the soil. So there's a built-in deficit of moisture for growing plants or for doing a lot of things that agriculture is dependent on pumping groundwater out of the ground or from reservoirs and so forth. And that line is right around the 100th meridian, which is a couple of hours west of where I'm sitting here in western Kansas. And I've seen some predictions that by the end of this century, the dry line might have moved almost to Kansas City, more than a couple of hundred miles to the east. And certainly where I am in Salina would be in that place where there is not enough water to grow crops without irrigation, and we probably wouldn't have much water available for irrigation by that time anyway.
Are experts at the Land Institute seeing the impacts of global warming already, and what do you hear from farmers?
Yes, I'll give one example, which has been a big pain for us. We grew for the first, 15-plus years of the sorghum program here. We were pretty much pest-free, and insects, mites, et cetera, were not a problem. It would just be very sporadic. Then starting in about 2015, we suddenly had an outbreak of the yellow sugarcane aphid, this little sucking insect that was a tropical pest, and in the Caribbean, in sugarcane growing areas, it would attack sugarcane. It would sometimes get into the very lower South Texas area where they grow sorghum. But with the winters getting warmer and warmer, suddenly every year since, the sugarcane aphid has made it up as far as Kansas, and it can really decimate a crop. And there's another insect that a couple of years later, it's even worse, that we suddenly started having problems with, that had been strictly a tropical, subtropical insect, which is the sorghum midge, this teeny tiny fly that lays its eggs where each seed is supposed to be developing, and so the plant basically produces no seed. And that's another one that we wouldn't be having if we had the kind of winters that we had in past decades.
I work with plants almost every day, other, out in the garden or in the greenhouse, and they inspire and amaze me, even the weeds, maybe especially the weeds. Stan, do you sometimes translate your plant knowledge into understanding the human crisis?
One thing that we say around here is that because we really believe that perennial crops are going to be necessary. We kind of jokingly say that our ancestors 10,000 years ago made a big mistake domesticating only annual crops, because at the time they were harvesting seed, hunter-gatherers, they were picking seed from both perennial and annual species, but for various technical reasons they domesticated only the annual species, so that now, over billions of acres around the world that had always been under natural ecosystems, in which almost 100% of the plants are typically perennial, they replaced those, and we continue to replace them with much more fragile annual monoculture ecosystems. And we're probably not going to solve the problems of agriculture until we get back to perennial systems.
Well, you are kind of a two-track guy. You work in detail on plants, but you also write big-picture books, at least six of them by my count. And I wonder, humans have this turbulent history. We can look back on our wars and our diseases and depressions. But are we in a different kind of crisis now, do you think? What makes this challenge different?
Yes, we're in the most serious crisis that humanity has faced, because now it's universal. It's not one region or another. And the world is going to be very different within just a couple of decades, not only because of climate change, but also because of we have overshot, transgressed several of these so-called planetary boundaries. We have this mass extinction event going on. We're losing daily, losing a lot of the biodiversity of the planet, the world's nitrogen and phosphorus cycles, and the water cycles are completely haywire because of industry. And both the world that we see around us today and these problems exist because of the fossil fuel bonanza of the past 100 years. And if we had not had those ancient fuels dug or pumped from the ground, we would not see anything like today's world would be, you know, more like the world of the 1700s. There would be fewer humans and a lot less stuff. But because of that, having that energy available and not restraining ourselves, today, believe it or not, the total human-made mass, that is everything that humanity has manufactured or built and is still standing, still in existence, outweighs the total standing biomass of the Earth. So it seems incomprehensible to me, but everything living on the Earth, weigh all of that up, it's dry matter, and it's less than what we've built and manufactured. And that trend is accelerated, and it's reaching a limit. It can't go on much longer.
In 2020, you published a book about ending the climate emergency while we still can. Noam Chomsky wrote the foreword. Do you think our current institutions can react quickly enough to save humanity from ourselves?
Well, yeah, things are happening fast because I wrote that book during 2019 and around 2018 and run-up to those midterm elections just 4 years ago. There was a lot of excitement. That's when people were talking about the Green New Deal. There seemed to be a lot of momentum behind it. Bernie Sanders' people got a World War II-style mobilization for climate into the Democratic Party platform, et cetera. And so I wrote the book in 2019 kind of saying, okay, how's it going with this? And you know, what will a Green New Deal do for us? And probably more importantly, what is it still lacking that we're going to have? Where are the holes in it? And the main hole was and still is, there's no direct surefire mechanism for phasing out fossil fuels completely, to take the quantities of oil, gas, and coal that are being extracted and burned, take it down in very rapid fire fashion year after year. But and other people were pushing ways to do this. We are demonstrating just verbally how it could be done, and it would be a big political lift, but it seemed non-feasible. Then after the disappointments of the past couple of years on failure to get any really significant climate legislation passed by Congress, and now looking at the possibility that we'll end up with, by a couple of years from now, far-right control of all three branches of government, it's looking dimmer all the time that the United States is going to manage to reduce its fossil fuel use or greenhouse gas emissions quickly enough to avoid some really catastrophic warming. And obviously, if we're not doing it, then the world as a whole is not going to do it either. There's a lot of talk and excitement about things like a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty by which the whole, not all the countries of the world would work together on reducing their fossil fuel use and emissions and so forth. But the prospects are not looking good. If the United States completely fails on this, then it's not going to be good.
Well, in another book, one of the solutions you considered in detail was rationing, and that may come yet for energy-challenged countries in Europe this winter. But I still see advertising pushing everyone to consume as much as possible, no limits, even though nature has limits. Could rationing actually be socially redeeming if we get that far?
And rationing is involved in the kind of policies that my colleagues and I have been pushing for, but rationing, rather than being the means of reducing consumption, rationing, its role is as an adaptation to short supply and high prices. That, like you, as you were saying, could be seeing rationing of heating fuel in Europe this winter. That would be because there's externally imposition of a shortage of fuel. Then the only way to have fairness and sufficiency, so everybody gets enough, but that it isn't used to excess, is with rationing. And that's what we've been pushing for, but in this case, self-imposed restraint, where we have a law that puts a cap on the amounts of oil, gas, and coal that can be extracted and burned, and then ratchets that cap down year by year. And that would, because that would have to happen faster than we can build up renewable energy capacity, it would mean the national energy supply would be going down by some amount, and that would almost certainly trigger a need for price controls and rationing, just as it did during World War II.
Your latest book is The Path to a Livable Future, A New Politics to Fight Climate Change, Racism, and the Next Pandemic. We are starting to run out of time, but could you briefly explain, are those three really connected, and should they be?
Yes, I wrote that one. The Green New Deal and Beyond came out in the spring of 2020, just as the first wave of COVID was hitting. And then a couple of months later, we had killing of George Floyd and the racial reckoning that we had during that summer. And my editor at City Lights Books said, I think you're going to need a sequel to the Green New Deal book. And so I, looking at it, the roots of all three of these problems, climate, systemic racism, and pandemics, are the roots are intertangled, both because of they all, to one extent or another, are either triggered by the abuse of ecosystems, or they have unequal, disparate consequences for different parts of the human species, different people, who different groups of people, and especially the marginalized communities, indigenous peoples, et cetera, the people least responsible for causing the problem, the ecological problems, have to pay the higher price, and not only with climate, but also certainly with the impacts of the pandemic on, take for example, migrant farm workers who, or the people working in meatpacking plants who were categorized as essential workers, so it doesn't matter. You've got to work under those same conditions that foster the spread of the virus. And in the case of the farm workers, they weren't given masks except on days when federal inspectors were going to be coming. Anyway, in the book, I describe how all of those, the collision of all those problems came in 2020, and discuss what, is there a way to avoid this in the future?
Well, yes, I think we have some people who think we'll just work on climate change and fix that, and then we'll get around to racism and public health. And no. It's one big complex, and they're all tied together, and we make it or we don't. From Salina, Kansas, and the Land Institute, we have been speaking with research fellow and author Stan Cox. You can find links to Stan and his works in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, and please check out landinstitute.org. Stan, it was great to talk with you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please stay tuned to Radio EcoShock Weekly as we broadcast science-based truth. Thank you for seeking out the hard truth, wherever it leads, and still caring about our world.